You're listening to an OTB AM podcast. You can watch the show or listen live every weekday morning at 7:45 AM. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream for more stuff just like this. A very good morning to you. Welcome along to Wednesday morning's OTB AM. We're here with you all the way until 9:30 this morning, and it's actually a really busy morning in terms of sports news. The news straight off the bat is that Joey Carberry's hamstring injury is worse than first feared, and so he will take no part in the Six Nations and may now also miss the... this is all reported by Keane Tracy in the Independent this morning. May also miss Munster's Heineken Cup quarter-final. Jack McGrath is in line to join Ulster at the end of the season. He apparently wants to get a bit more game time, and it's apparently coming from him as opposed to David Nusafora or Leinster.
Very interesting news this morning. Like, Ulster in that position, like, we've always spoken over the last couple of years about Ulster being in trouble when it comes to up front, but they've uncovered Eric O'Sullivan this year at Lucid, who's had kind of something of a... he's been something of a revelation, really, over the past couple of months. Been really impressed with him. So ultimately, Jack McGrath is there to maybe kind of guide him to the next level, as well as perhaps delivering a bit of competition in that position. So I guess from an Ulster perspective, it makes great sense when you're getting a British and Irish lion into your squad. From a Leinster perspective, I thought Jack McGrath still had a part to play. But then again, was it Ed Byrne who scored two tries at the weekend in the Pro 14 from that position? So they're well stocked as well, Leinster, as they tend to be. But it comes back to the initial question. Are Leinster just, you know, the feeding ground for the rest of the provinces?
Yeah, Johnny Walters hopes to be back before the end of the season, which is great news. Michael Obafemi's out for the rest of the season with a hamstring injury as well. These young Irish wunderkinds and their hamstrings not going so well at the moment. And there was one other story that is not in my version of the Indo, but is also in the back of the Indo. Andrew McLaughlin is saying that the... is this in the Mail?
Irish Daily Mail.
In the Mail, yeah, okay. So that Andrew McLaughlin, the former Kildare footballer, is saying that he finds it curious that the GPA have been quiet on the issue of two home games in the Super 8s for Dublin. And he feels like there's a conflict of interest in the fact that the CEO of the GPA is a current Dublin Gaelic footballer. So plenty for us to get our teeth stuck into. And on top of that, we've got Gary Breen coming your way to talk about many of the football stories this morning, including Ole Gunnar Solskjaer admitting that the high-intensity training has resulted in many of his players being injured. Now, is Ole Gunnar Solskjaer going to... does he care? Is he like the wages of sin or death? And so, therefore, we have decided not to sin and we're winning games and there's going to be some collateral damage.
Yeah. Like he said, when do you want me to do this? Do you want me to pick it up immediately when I get the keys? Or do you want me to just wait till next season when I may not have the job?
Exactly.
So it's a no-brainer from Solskjaer's perspective.
Yeah, run them into the ground now and let them recuperate in the summer. I did also immediately remember the stories about Jurgen Klopp being a terrible idiot when it came to training teams. He took over around the same time? A little bit earlier in the season? And by Christmas, everybody's complaining about his training methods. Well, everybody, some sports scientists on Twitter were complaining about his training methods. And lo and behold, a couple of years later, the injury problems of Liverpool aren't that bad, right? So Solskjaer's done exactly the right thing here. And if players are going to get injured at this stage of the season, he's established his reputation. There's plenty more players to come through, right?
Yeah, it's more to do with the shock in the system, isn't it? That players have, you know, got away with not doing too many sprints, and then they suddenly have to sprint quite a lot. Now, the thing is, when it comes to distance covered, I don't think there's too much of a difference between Jose Mourinho and Solskjaer. It's just to do with the amount of high-intensity sprints that they have to do within a game, and that's obviously kind of given them a lot of muscle injuries. And they were dropping like flies on Sunday. It was incredible to watch. And there were some crazy stories during the rounds that, you know, that they've tried to like utilise garlic on the pitch at Old Trafford to make the grass grow a bit better, and that might have had some sort of impact. I believe that wasn't actually anything more than a conspiracy theory.
Wow, what an amazing conspiracy theory. What was
it's been a great season for pitch conspiracy theories.
Is there science behind it?
I'm not quite sure what the science is, but I believe there is science behind it, yes. That if, like, I'm not sure what your lawn is like, but if you want to use garlic on it, it might actually do the trick for you. Just don't put any football players out in it. They might pull a hamstring or two.
Not great, it's tiny.
Well, you know, it's probably small enough for a Manchester United player to get injured on it. But as I say, it has been a great season for pitch conspiracy theories. Between like the half and half cut that they did on Anfield, And what was the other one? It was in the Liverpool Manchester City game, the second one where the snow, it wasn't cutting it half and half. Yeah. They only cleared half the pitch of Anfield in front of the games. And then there was obviously the cutting of the grass in certain areas as well, which left the grass longer in areas for the Manchester City game. So really, we've been spoiled for choice pitch theories this year.
Not to mention Bárki Cuíve, which we'll get to, because a war of words has broken out between former officers of the Cork County Board and current directors of the Cork Bárki Cuíve Stadium. And, well, they've just claimed that the interview that Peter McKenna gave to the Examiner contained an incorrect figure, and they maintained that they were damaged by that, as opposed to the massive overrun which the Cork County Board oversaw. So we'll come to that story a little bit later and give you more details on it, but I don't know, picking a fight with Croke Park doesn't seem like the smartest course of action when you desperately needed their help to bail you out. So we'll see how that one ends. Let's move on, because Johnny Sexton was in yesterday checking out his new desk in Off the Ball Towers, and we've got a 20-minute interview coming up a little bit later on. But obviously, the game against Munster and the incident with Joey Carberry came up. Have a look.
In your position, it probably helps that, you know, Joey's gone and he's starting games at 10 for Munster at this point. As we saw in Thomond Park around Christmas time, there's no lost love when you're wearing your provincial jerseys.
Yeah, look, a lot was made about that. A lot of nothing, really. Like, I spoke to Joey after the game and I couldn't believe the reaction. I had to do a press conference after. I couldn't believe the reaction of that. Like, there was a middle up beside the touchline. I pulled him out and I didn't realise. He probably wasn't expecting it, but he went down much heavier than I planned. And there was no words exchanged. I just said, get out of there, whatever. And I spoke to him after the game and said, look, I couldn't believe the reaction in the press conference. They were all trying to, you know, create a story about it. Just once, you know, there was nothing there. And he said, of course, like, there's no. So the amount of stuff that happened in that game, and it all came back to me, it was quite comical. But there's some good learnings in there for me in terms of how everything is going to be a little bit more in the spotlight sort of after last year.
Yeah. I mean, it's mad how history repeats that, like, when O'Gara's coming in, there's David Humphreys there. And when Sexton's coming in, there's O'Gara there. And now when Joey Carberry's coming in, there's Sexton there. And nobody ever gave it up without a fight. And actually producing even more than they had done beforehand, so.
Yeah, and like, he gets into this as well when we played a full interview later on about the idea of what duty does the first choice player have to the person who's behind them in the queue.
I mean, the correct answer that, I don't know, I haven't seen this interview yet, the correct answer is, oh yeah, obviously we try and help them along, but the truth is, over my dead body.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can slit my throat, and as my blood is gurgling out, I will be trying to wrestle you to the ground.
Well, exactly, especially on a year like this. Especially when, you know, you're World Player of the Year, when people are kind of criticising your performances, all Six Nations, and I guess rightly so, you're going to cling on to that jersey in an even more tight manner. So there's no way he's letting anyone come in behind him, but it's like he's saying that he's actually got to be asked for ideas about how to improve your game, and, you know, people don't necessarily ask questions, they just kind of stand there and they kind of
what do you mean?
They, like, as in Johnny Sexton says, Joey Carberry hasn't actually asked him for any tips.
Yeah,
but that's not exactly how it works. He didn't ask Ronan O'Gara for tips.
He got
skilled by osmosis.
Yeah, and then you plan how to kill, like, and then ultimately they all become mates at the end. But that's how it works, right?
Yeah, mates at the very, very end, probably after the end.
yeah, okay. All right, let's move on. We'll tell you what's coming up on the show. I've already told you a little bit of this, but Gary Breen's coming your way at around about 8:10. We'll bring in Johnny Sexton 8:25. Sports news with Darren Cleary around about 8:45, and we'll be talking about the Six Nations 2019 at around about 9:10 this morning. As ever, if you want to get involved, you can just use the hashtag OTBAM on Twitter. If you haven't tried this just yet, if you want, it's just some background noise as you go about your business in your kitchen or wherever it is. You can just listen to this show. Get on to offtheball.com, and in the top corner of the website, and we should do a little graphic for this actually, because that might show you how it works. Offtheball.com. Yeah, so there's a big listen button and an arrow, and if you just click that, then if I do that now,
it works. Offtheball.com.
There you go, look. 5 seconds late. And then I can hit silence, and there you go. It works like a radio station.
Was that a proper dad moment for you, where it took you 5 seconds to find the silence button?
No, that was on purpose. Okay. That's not how it works.
No, fair enough. We definitely believe you.
How's your trip to Budapest, Owen?
Oh, yeah, it was good.
You see many of the sights?
Yeah, loads of sights.
Amazing museums they have over there.
Yeah, they really do.
Real cultural, you know, it's like at the interface of two different civilizations, one of the great historic sites of the world.
Mm. Yeah, the remnants of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, remnants of the Ottoman Empire, you name it.
Yeah. It's, how much did you see, Owen?
A victim of empire.
There's the graphic. Tommy has it.
There you go.
Yeah, it's looking good there on screen.
See the way I filled for a minute and a half. So you did nothing but drink, basically?
I wouldn't
a matching scar on this side, was that ever on the...
wouldn't necessarily say that. I think that's...
There's a Show Your Stripes movement coming for the 20 by 20. You'll just have to do... One on one side and two
just
on the other.
Get one other scar, yeah. So I'll get on that bandwagon eventually.
All right, let's bring in the newspapers from this morning. And, there's plenty to get talking about this morning. Ireland and Munster hit by Carberry injury blow. This is the story that Cian Tracy has. Joey Carberry is set to miss the remainder of Ireland's Six Nations campaign. And he's also now considered a major doubt for the Munster European Cup final. Sorry, European Heineken European Cup quarter final against Edinburgh next month. Jesus. Okay, so this means that Jack Carty is more than likely going to be retained on the bench and Ross Byrne will be called up to the squad. So that's not great.
No.
He didn't get game time, didn't get a chance to show what he could do. And
well, Scotland was at least some consolation from the Six Nations that he managed to get a bit longer than he would have hoped for in that game because Sexton went down fairly early. But you suspect that Joe Schmidt definitely had plans, or strong considerations at least, to get Joey Carberry in there for a sustained amount of time before the Six Nations was out.
Who knows? They wanted to try and win the competition now, and because their form isn't great, they're trying to get everybody back into form. And I also think that, like, the notion that this is all just down to Sexton's form is, like, not right. The opposition, obviously, are closing down everything that Ireland have been able to do over a period of time and have left it all on Sexton's shoulders to try and completely make our game start working. But, like, what about our starter plays? What about all the other things that we do without Sexton in games? It turns out that they're all failing at the moment as well because teams seem to have worked us out.
Yeah. Like, I do think that the Carberry situation was more to do with just getting in more test minutes, wasn't it? Like, I guess it was accelerated by the fact that Ireland had played so poorly so far in this year Six Nations that you're allowed to rotate a little bit more, or it's a little bit more acceptable. But I certainly think that the main reason why Joey Carberry would have got more minutes between now and the end of the Six Nations was just because he is essentially backup for Johnny Sexton, and we need the backup for Johnny Sexton at this year's World Cup to be ready to go and to be as good a replacement as possible. Now with Jack Carty coming in, maybe he's the one who's going to get the opportunities over the next couple of weeks, and like maybe that'll be a positive down the line as well. Who knows? You don't know what situation we're going to be in come the end of the year.
No, we don't. Duff joins Lennon team as boys pick up the pieces. So obviously that's a picture of Brendan Rodgers in the back of the Indo there this morning as well. But the news that Damien Duff has received a quick promotion to a coaching role with Celtic's first team squad in the reshuffle after the departure of Brendan Rodgers to Leicester. And then Jack McGrath is set to join Ulster, which, this is a very left field story, it seems. So there's McGrath and Jordy Murphy on the field in Bilbao last year alongside Tadhg Furlong, obviously, and two of those three players it looks like could be playing for Ulster next season. Now it's understood McGrath and the IRFU have been frustrated with his lack of starting opportunities at Leinster, and he's been pitched to Ulster as a solution to their need for more front row resources. It's understood that McGrath initiated the move and talks are at an advanced stage. I don't know.
Well, is it a surprise that he initiated the move?
Well, look, if it's coming from the player, fair play. It's a real pity. I think Jack McGrath's great, and I think that, like, Cian Healy's not going to go on forever, so. But look, he's a great player, and if he ends up at Ulster, Ulster are going to really benefit from that. So, quite unforgivable. This is a mad story. This is Cork coming out fighting against Peter McKenna. Ryan hits out at Croker chief McKenna over Páirc Uí redevelopment cost claim. So, bear in mind that there is a massive overrun in how much it was anticipated it was going to cost to redevelop Páirc Uí. Just bear that in mind, right? And the people who oversaw that are now complaining that somebody else said this massive overrun was going to be of a magnitude that's a bit bigger than it actually is, according to them. Now, that's what this story is here. The Cork County Board needed bailed out by Croke Park and the GAA at central level. And now they're complaining about the fact that their reputation has been damaged by somebody saying that the overrun was going to be of a magnitude that's slightly bigger. What?
Yeah, it's like someone who's burnt down a house and they've got blamed for burning down the full house, but actually the porch is left standing. And they're like, hey, hold on a minute, you can't criticise us because we burnt down all of the house except for the little bit at the front. Like, there is a huge amount of reasons for them just to not say anything here and just take the help that they've been given and take whatever bad press they've got over the past couple of months.
Because the bad press isn't about how much the size of the overrun, it's about the fact that there was an overrun in the first place. Like, so it was supposed to cost 70 million, right? It's now, the current board say it's going to cost 90 million, and Peter McKenna's figure was 110 million at in the interview that he gave with the Examiner. And this has annoyed... so it turns out it's a former Cork chairman who has said that it's the unforgivable reputational damage. Michael O'Flynn, the developer, has been put on the board and has been asked to come up with a figure. He's come up with the 90 million, and he said that there was no basis for the 110 million figure. But it doesn't. So Bob Ryan is the former Cork County Board Chairman. He says, the most disappointing aspect of this is the interview Peter McKenna did with the Irish Examiner and the reputational damage it has done to this county board, the GAA nationally, and to individuals involved in the redevelopment of the stadium is quite unforgivable. Really? Is it unforgivable to point out that there's a massive overrun and that they didn't have a handle on it and that they needed bailed out and they needed somebody else to ride into town and rescue them? Is it unforgivable to point that out? Or is it actually finally somebody in the GAA going, hang on a second, what the hell's going on here? Where's this money gone? How are you spending it? Where did this overrun come from? What is the actual figure, lads? What, tell us the truth about the figures. It seems to me that's what Peter McKenna did. And now you have a former Cork County Board Chairman going, oh, well, we were grand. Yeah.
Do we know the actual final figure?
No, because at least Michael Flynn came out and said, there's a bunch of different things that are going to happen. Some renegotiation, some potential disputes and other things in a project this size. This is our best guesstimate for what the spread and the cost is going to be. But it has to be addressed and has to be dealt with going forward. It cannot be allowed to happen that people in a position as he is in are allowed to behave in such a manner and so reckless. He hasn't been reckless. He hasn't been reckless with money. He's come in and said, you guys need to get a handle on this. It's the opposite of reckless. This is mad from Bob Ryan. The last 2 months, what the people involved in GAA in this county have suffered is just disgraceful as they've presided over an overrun for a stadium project and needed bailed out by Croke Park. I hope we can resolve whatever has to be resolved and stabilise the whole situation. This kind of stuff can never be left happen again. Well, you're dead right. You've massively underestimated the cost of redeveloping Porky Cueve. It definitely can't be allowed to happen again.
Do Croke Park just say to them now, screw you?
I don't know. If you were Croke Park, you'd be like, all right, let's, yeah, maybe. I mean, they can't, obviously, because they're not like that. They're going to rise above this.
And Porky Cueve is kind of important as well.
Massive provocation, you would hope, and go, okay, let's see how you get on yourselves. I don't know. It seems like you do not understand what has happened here. And all you're feeling is sorry for yourself, despite the fact that your organisation has presided over this massive cost overrun, which has put the entire organisation in Cork and beyond in jeopardy. And then you've been rescued and you're complaining about the rescuers.
Mm. Yeah, because they've actually spoken out and said something which maybe...
Told the truth.
Yeah. And to be fair, there was always, like, correct me if I'm wrong here, but Peter McKenna's initial statement in the Irish Examiner went something along the lines of, it could get up to 110 million. It wasn't like, I have a definite figure here, and this is exactly what it's going to be. But he said it was going to get up to 110 million quid, and it seems that it's going to be a bit lower than that for sure. But the big element to take away from this is that it is still a massive overspend on the entire project. Like, what sort of standoff do you want here? I want to see Croke Park say, no, you're not getting any grass from Knoll. You're going to have to grow your own grass in Cork to replace the field in Parky Cueve.
Yeah.
That's the sort of standoff I want to see.
Just a sandy pitch. Okay, so the Times Ireland edition. Leicester pay Celtic 6 million for Rodgers, which is good business for Celtic, I suppose, but they do have Neil Lennon in for the rest of the season with Damien Duff as part of his coaching ticket. It didn't look like Neil Lennon was ever going to get that Celtic job again, but here he is, a perfect confluence of events where, by mutual consent, he leaves his Hibs job. Never quite got to the bottom of what happened there. And now Damien Duff is part of that team. If you were Duff, would you have preferred to... I mean, he did say Celtic was in his heart. Would you prefer to go with Brendan Rodgers to the new gig at Leicester or and have like a lower job or a higher up job at Celtic?
It's a very good question. I would personally say Leicester City because I think the Premier League and the Scottish Premiership right now are poles apart. And the potential for Leicester City, with the players that they have, and like with a decent enough budget, can be pushing for a comfortable top half of the table year after year and become that seventh place team potentially as well. So I think that, in comparison to being, you know, one who's going after the 10 in a row in Scotland, as bizarre as it sounds, is actually a better alternative. But it is still a relatively meteoric rise from Damien Duff's perspective.
Yeah.
Like, given the role he was at with, like, after Shamrock Rovers to this now at Celtic, it's very, very quick, and I'm delighted to see him get it, and it's a great opportunity for him because, like, you don't want to say there's a safety blanket around Celtic, but there's always a chance you're going to win a trophy every season, that it's not exactly the easiest team to fail with. And when I say fail, I mean, you know, don't win a trophy.
Yeah, the league. It has to be the league.
But it has to be the league.
Nicholls, Clan, the man for Gold Cup. Fired up Paul Nicholls believes he has his best Cheltenham Festival team in years and that big Bulmers Cheltenham Gold Cup hope. Clan des Oboes has even more improvement to come. We are calling it the Bulmers Gold Cup, aren't we? We're not, like, using Magnus. Have we just decided that? I think we have. Ireland, we did that. Okay, so there's your broadsheets this morning.
Back page of the Irish Daily Mail this morning is Boiling Point. Sexton expresses his frustration with Ireland's poor form. And you've also got a picture there of Brendan Rodgers watching Leicester beat Brighton 2-1 last night. Foxes off the flying start in front of new boss, reads the headline. And that is that story here as well by Micheál Clifford regarding Andrew McLaughlin, the former Kildare footballer who's hit out of the GPA's deafening silence on the GAA's decision to allow Dublin to have two Croke Park games in this summer's Super 8 series. The back page of the Herald this morning is Brexit. Lennon back at paradise as Duff moves up ladder, and blow for Mick as Obafemi is ruled out. So that's Michael Obafemi's hamstring injury, which according to his manager Ralph Hasenhüttl is fairly serious for his career.
Out for the rest of the season and has potential to damage his career. Like, you don't really want to hear that. You just hope it's like not very precise English from Hasenhüttl and he's gone for the rest of the season. It's very early if he's gone for the rest of the season.
Yeah, it is. And when you have a season-ending injury at that age and at that point in your career, it's always got to be a little bit of a worry. And maybe that's what he means. Yeah. Maybe he thinks that these next few months were actually a pivotal time for Michael Obafemi and now he's not going to get that vital pitch time or whatever it may be.
Well, they sign players now over the summer who are strikers who they feel will be available for them the whole time.
Hmm. Back page of the Mirror is glad to be back. Lennon says, I'm delighted to be returning to one of the biggest and best clubs in world football. And Rodgers here saying, I'll take Leicester forward. Brendan Rodgers has interestingly said, I'll give my life to this club on three separate occasions. So he's given his life for Liverpool, he's given his life for Celtic, and now he said he's going to give his life for Leicester City. Back page of the Irish Daily Star is Fox Office. Rodgers ditches Celts for Leicester. Oba out for the rest of the season, and Sexton is sorry for Rome temper. We'll hear from him a little bit later on OTBAM. Bottle of the Bridge, says the headline on the back of the Sun this morning. Sarri's ready to axe rebel keeper Kepa, and Pochettino says, we lack desire and fight to be champs. Pretty harsh words from Mauricio Pochettino this morning, saying that they don't really have the mentality to actually go on and win the Premier League, and they're going to be waiting 10 years to win the title.
What does that mean? That means, come and get me, Man United, come and get me.
Mm.
Right?
Isn't I'm not going to run your players to the ground. Look at all those hamstrings popping. I can make sure your team is extremely fit, and we're not going to pop any hamstrings. But the fact of the matter is that he'll come in the summer and that they'll actually be used to the workload, and Solskjaer will just have paved the way for him. The Daily Telegraph this morning goes with Foxes get their man. Rodgers takes over at Leicester and sees his new side beat Brighton. Nice three-piece suit from Brendan Rodgers there last night. And Pochettino there saying title win could take 10 years. And then finally, for me for now, it's the back of the Guardian. That's a picture of Brendan Rodgers there again, overseeing Leicester beating Brighton. The Rodgers effect. New manager is all smiles as Leicester respond to his appointment with victory. And Dominic Fifield's talking about the Chelsea rift this morning. Sarri threatens to leave out Aretha Balaga for team's sake. The fact that he's threatening to leave him out and hasn't already said, well, this guy's obviously just not playing.
Well, so did you read the way that it was reported? So there's been a fine handed down.
Mm.
Did you read that?
Yes.
Who handed down the fine?
A week's wages. It wasn't Sarri himself.
The board handed down a week's fine.
Yeah.
I mean, what?
It's very strange. Like, when you looked at Sarri's reaction initially on Sunday, and you saw the way he kind of said, well, I misinterpreted the fact that he had cramp or didn't have cramp, whatever. You thought, well, this is just kind of covering the story for a little while, and he is going to absolutely tear into Kepa, and he is going to rule with an iron fist over this man's career for as long as Maurizio Sarri survives at Chelsea Football Club. And it seems that actually it's been relatively lenient, that Sarri himself, as you say, hasn't actually been the one who handed down the fine. Sarri himself has said that he might actually play tonight, which I just think is a little bit ridiculous.
Or if your cover story, if you're sticking to it, you have to stick to it and you have to play him. And that, like,
but the cover story's gone out the window now. Like, once the fine was handed down, what are you fining him for? Because of a misinterpretation?
Well, for not being better at communication.
Well, the way I'm looking at it, like, Sarri hasn't said it, but it seems that the cover story, everybody's just accepted this clearly did not happen. This kind of cover story that he came up with. So, like, he's also been speaking up Willy Caballero as a very good goalkeeper and a great man, and he is a point of reference in the dressing room for his personality, for his behaviour, for everything. So I think he has the maturity to be ready for everything.
Yeah. Including coming in for our 80 million quid goalkeeper. Right, here is the Brendan Rodgers announcement from Leicester City yesterday. We're going to get to where Gary Breen straight away after this. So, welcome, Brendan. I'm delighted to be... Here we go.
I'm delighted to be named manager of this fantastic football club. At Leicester City, the foundations are in place for us to grow and achieve many things. Hopefully, with my experiences and the talent of the players in our squad, we can be successful together. See you all soon.
Gary Breen, good morning to you.
Morning, lads.
Is Brendan Rodgers going to be successful?
Listen, I think he's certainly a quality manager, and everything is set up there. It has surprised me, though, not only the timing of leaving Celtic, where he's on the cusp of something special in terms of winning the some more trophies as such to go over all so many he has already. But I don't know. I always felt that Brendan Rodgers was desperate to get back to the Premier League. I think a lot of people will probably look at Leicester and think to leave Celtic for Leicester just shows you the financial muscle of the Premier League, that a club like that can lure away the Celtic manager. But it does bode well. But once again, I just look at the scenario with Leicester player, similar to what happens at Chelsea as such. Since that incredible title win, seems that those iconic players flex their muscles when they don't play the way they want to play. If anyone tries to evolve the way they play, which you have to do, because the way that they won the league is redundant to a certain extent now, because teams have learnt to sit deep on Vardy, so you have to have a more controlled possession. Puel tried to do that. The previous managers, Ranieri, even tried to do that. Turner didn't like it. So Brendan Rodgers coming in now doesn't play that way. He has a philosophy in terms of being expansive football, so it'd be a big test. But there are certainly some young players at Leicester that he'll be excited about, the likes of Maddison, Gray, Chilwell, Barnes, Maguire. So that old guard that did that iconic Premier League win will be phased out soon enough.
Yeah. In terms of his style of play, does it work for a middle-tier Premier League team, and can it get them... Like, you know, I almost don't know what the point of qualifying for the Europa League is, because most Premier League teams in Leicester's situation probably will put out a B team when they get to the Europa League anyway. But is it the type of team who will finish in that 6th to 10th, potentially a 5th over the next couple of seasons?
Well, listen, that's how they think of themselves. And you have to look at the facts at times, because you hear a lot of people, you hear even Peter Schmeichel coming out and saying that if they get a better coach, they'll be between 5th and 8th. Well, since they won the title, they've never been 5th, they've never been 6th, and they've rarely been 7th. I think 3 times this season under Puel, once last year they were. But I think they've got ideas of grandeur, to be perfectly honest. I know the owners want to take the club forward, and they've tried to build on that amazing Premier League win. But the reality is, I don't see them getting into the top 6.
Do you buy the idea that Claude Puel was this sort of tame, timid manager? Like, it certainly came across that way when he was speaking in front of the media, but I saw a manager who got furious a number of times on the sideline, that I'm not really sure if it is like a lack of energy or whatever it may be in the Leicester City dressing room, that there may be a different problem going on here.
Oh yeah, listen, I hope I alluded to it there. I think the players literally, if they don't like the way they're playing, they literally let it be known. They drip feed it into the media. And of course, the supporters will back them all the way, because they are their most famous players as such. But I agree with you. I don't think he is timid. Puel certainly wasn't, as a player, quite vocal. And I think he is as a manager. But I just think he has a calm demeanour in front of the camera. And perception is so important in modern day football. Probably people take that as a weakness. I for one moment believe that. I think the problem you ultimately have at Leicester is that, and similar to Southampton, he finishes 8th in the Premier League, gets them to the League Cup final. but he constantly chops and changes the team to the frustration of the players, to the frustration of the supporters. And as a result, it looks like he's a little bit of a tinker man. And that's just the problem that you have, is that he didn't really bond with the player straight away. The flip side of that is you hear Brendan Rodgers, and he puts on his little announcements when he comes in, and he can be a bit sickly at times in terms of how he talks, but certainly he can back it up. I think he is a top manager.
Yeah, for whatever reason, there's always been that. Is it the sickliness? There's just a... He doesn't have people's faith, I think, just yet as a top manager, even though he took that Liverpool team to within the Steven Gerrard slip of winning the title. People kind of write that off because he had Luis Suarez playing so ridiculously well. Also Coutinho, I suppose. So that was there was the bones of a really good team there. He doesn't get any credit for that, though, because Suarez is the one who gets the credit. What he does at Celtic, everybody goes, well, it's Celtic and Rangers are a complete joke while he's there. But at the same time, I don't know, he's always, I found, been quite impressive if you strip away the veneer, and the documentary obviously didn't help. But
yeah, no, listen, I totally agree with you there. You're quite right in terms of, I think he probably needs to, he probably would have looked at it and thought he would have potentially been in. I know he talked about being linked to the Arsenal job when Wenger left. That was never going to happen. And obviously his young coaching career at Chelsea has a bond there. Perhaps he'll go in there. But I think he's been quite methodical in thinking, listen, I need to maybe take a step back as such, take a team like Leicester, improve them, and then get on the radar of the other teams. But I do think he is a good manager. And I think there's a body of work that he's been doing since he was a young man. I know he finished his playing career very early, so he's been able to coach for a long time. Initially goes into Watford and Reading and can't really put his philosophy on them, struggled. So it looked like he might not get to where he wants to be. But ever since then, I think he has impressed with the clubs he's been with.
Gary, what's your take on, say, some anger from Celtic fans that he's left in the middle of the season or beyond the midway point in the season, coming up to a pivotal trophy-winning point of the year? Like, it seems to me that Brendan Rodgers would know more than most that loyalty can be a two-way street when it comes to football. That did he necessarily need to be loyal to Celtic Football Club, given how he knows that a manager could get sacked any day now?
Well, yes, I understand that. And you would have your mindset that, listen, football does change very quickly within a week, but supporters will quite rightly say about loyalty, the timing just doesn't sit right, does it? It's not a case that Leicester desperately need him to avoid relegation, although the home supporters believe that they were struggling so much that they were in danger of it, especially with teams down the bottom starting to win now. But I think this could have been done in the summer. You just feel that he could have seen the job out at Celtic and then left, and everyone would have said, listen, thank you, you've been brilliant, thank you so much. But the very fact that he keeps talking about him being a Celtic manager, I'll do anything for this club, and then you leave at this stage of the season, it doesn't sit well, does it?
No. On the other side, it's great news for Damien Duff. Or is it? If you were Duff, we were asking this question a little bit earlier on, would you prefer to be part of the expanded team at Leicester and have a smaller role, or is it better now at this stage of your career to get a higher role under the interim manager at Celtic?
Well, I think ultimately, I think Damien, I haven't spoke to him, but I'm sure that in the initial job that he got at Celtic, they've probably been asked to step up now to the first team for the remainder of this season. But I probably think he'll protect that job if he can go back to it. Whether or not Lennon continues, then they can address it then. But I think Damien was quite open in saying, I wouldn't really have left Ireland for any other team than Celtic. Certainly at this stage of his coaching career, it's early development, and listen, it's great that he's coming to the forefront. We want to see that. But he's got a long way to go in terms of learning his trade as a coach.
So, essentially, if Lennon doesn't get the gig, then he can go back to the academy
Was. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I think so. And I think that's a great way to learn your skills. It's something that Brendan Rodgers done. I think at times, too often, players with brilliant careers are given top jobs. They're not ready for it. It's simple as that. You go into coaching, it's totally different. It's a totally different remit. It doesn't matter that you're a top player. That goes out of the window within a week of being in front of those players. You need to learn your craft.
Chelsea are obviously playing tonight for the first time since the situation at the weekend. We were talking about it there. Kepa was fined a week's wages by the board, is how it's been reported. Not fined a week's wages by the manager, not fined a week's wages by the club. It was specifically the board. It does seem as if Sarri's reputation is being damaged by each tiny little cut that happens in the aftermath of the massive thing that happened at the weekend. Does he play him tonight? Does he not play him tonight? Does it matter anymore?
Well, I think it does matter. I would hope that he doesn't play him. Initially, when I saw it all developing, I thought maybe there's a bit of confusion in terms of the fact that they couldn't get the message on that he was okay to continue. But the more you read about it, essentially it looked like they were making a substitution to get Cavallero on for penalties because he's a superior keeper at saving them. So for him to dismiss it and not come off, and even the wink to the camera and all that type of stuff, and the resulting things like the apparently clashing with players, and it's just an absolute mess. The very fact that Azpilicueta, as the captain, didn't come over and deal with the situation was a nonsense. And you're just seeing it throughout this Chelsea team. Sarri looked like someone who had real control. I'm a massive admirer of what he'd done at Napoli. I know it took him 18 months to do that. And initially when he came into Chelsea, he started so well, but it's funny that they're playing Tottenham tonight, and ultimately Pochettino is the one that totally dismantled this whole Sarri ball theory. I know that Everton went to Stamford Bridge and negated Jorginho with Sigurdsson putting him on there, got a 0-0 draw. But the way that Tottenham destroyed Chelsea, everyone has followed, and I think there's real problems there. Even the very fact, and I know people might say you're a bit of a killjoy, the way that Hazard took that penalty where if he missed, they had lost the cup. To try that chip just shows you everything about Chelsea. They're all about themselves, them players.
Yeah, I mean, it was cool though.
Yeah, listen, it was cool. But if you're a player, you're thinking, just put it in the back of the net. Why even put it at risk like that? It's a nonsense.
Yeah, okay. You don't like the Rabonas generally then? Is that like a...
Yeah, there's a time
Gary Wayne rule. Yeah, training, the training ground,
play.
Is that it?
Well, no, you can do it on the pitch, but I don't know. Listen, I know he's executed it well, but it was the flippancy with it he took in. It just sums him up that he literally felt, well, listen, I miss it. It doesn't really matter. It does matter.
Yeah, okay. The point about the 18 months at Napoli is very important because presumably Chelsea realised this when they signed him and now they're in the throes of it. Do they just rip this up now because of what's happened and go, yeah, okay, we've got to pick our 80 million goalkeeper over you because ultimately we can get another one of you, but we can't get another one of those?
I know, it's such a similar story at Chelsea. They always seem to be in crisis mode and they cope with it. You know, you can't argue with it. The very fact they've got 15 major trophies in the time that Abramovich has been there. 13 different managers in different disguises, whether it interim, whatever, just shows you that they can cope with this, and it's another story. And you're right, I think you made the decision to get him in saying that they want to evolve, they want to try to play a different style of football. But the managers must look at what's gone before him. Similar to Antonio Conte, he wins the Premier League, then he starts flexing his muscles thinking, well, listen, give me control now. And then when he doesn't, he thinks, well, why not? And you just think, because no manager gets that. The hierarchy make the decisions there. And listen, there could be any announcements in the next couple of days. And either way it went, it wouldn't shock you.
Like, I think what this whole saga has shown us that you can empower your players to a certain point, but then player power can become dangerous at a certain point. And I think what some managers have shown, including the opposite manager tonight, Maurizio Pochettino, is the positive side of player empowerment and actually kind of showing kind of a loving touch towards your players. But then you read his comments in the newspapers this morning, and it says, hard as I've seen stuff from Maurizio Pochettino, saying that they didn't show the will against Burnley, that they didn't deserve anything, that it's going to be a 10-year wait for the Premier League. What they showed on Saturday was that we are a good team, that they have quality, but not enough to win a Premier League title. That is the reality, that they can get up for the big games, but not for the so-called weaker teams in the Premier League. It's harsh stuff from Maurizio Pochettino, showing a sort of mental weakness within this Tottenham team.
It's honest though, isn't it? I think it just sums everything up. And there is an inferiority complex at Tottenham. There always has been. And this is his biggest issue. He's built a brilliant, young, vibrant team, but he can't get them over the line. Because they just can't do it. This Spursy tag keeps happening. For them to go and lose at Burnley, when if they had won, they'd have closed the gap on the leaders to 2 points, and they weren't able to do that. And he's right. I totally agree with him. And people say it's harsh. Sometimes you have to tell, well, not sometimes, you have to be honest with these players. But those group of players will accept it, I think. I think they'll think, okay, there'll be the mindset where, all right, we'll prove you wrong. And they won't feel any less about their manager, whereas the others, like at Chelsea and Leicester to a certain extent, are like, no, we don't listen to it, get another manager. They all idolise their manager at Tottenham. There's no doubt. Even players who haven't quite been able to make it there, the Masons, that type of guys who got their chance at Tottenham under Pochettino, weren't good enough to stay there, had to move on, still talk glowingly about him all the time. He is a top manager.
Yeah, so if you're Pochettino, This is the best work of your life if you can keep it going for a while. Like, there's a strain in me that wants to see what happens if this experiment continues. The new stadium will happen. Revenue will increase. Their debt ratio will go down. At some point, you would hope the owner and Daniel Levy will realise that if we invest a little bit, we'll actually be worth way more. Suddenly, all of the investment would make more sense. And you have genuinely world-class manager. So, like, is it always grass greener, more money, Man United, or whoever that next job for Pochettino is? Or is this actually the perfect job?
I think it's the perfect job for him right now, but I can quite easily see him being a man that returns Manchester United back to the top. The problem that Pochettino has is that if he was ever going to take the United job, had to be a clean break after Mourinho. The very fact that Scholes has come in now and just rejuvenated the whole club, the supporters love him, he'd be under the type of pressure he doesn't need initially. If there's an indifferent start, that half the crowd or the majority of the crowd will say, why didn't you give it to Solskjaer? But I think at 45 years of age, Pochettino's got time. The only problem is the Manchester United job does not come round a lot. The Real Madrid job does. It comes every two or three seasons. So that will always happen. He'll always be available for that. I don't see his body of work deteriorating to the extent that won't happen again. But the timing is everything. And Manchester United job, you know, if Solskjaer comes in, you look like he could potentially have that for a long time.
Just to touch on United and Liverpool before we wrap, Gary, we'll start with United and an interesting story this week around Manchester United's fitness. We will have all seen it at Old Trafford on Sunday. So basically, Solskjaer has owned up to the fact that maybe he is responsible for some of the muscle injuries that they've sustained. In terms of statistics, their running has actually gone down from 181 kilometres to 107.7 kilometres under Solskjaer, from Jose to Solskjaer. But the sprints have increased from 98.6 per game to 108.6 per game. They went on a warm weather training camp after a fairly intensive Christmas period, and Solskjaer has basically owned up and said this may be why my players are dropping like flies. Do you think it's fair enough that Solskjaer has done this, because ultimately it has resulted in a fairly quick turnaround in form?
Yeah, I can understand as soon as the manager goes in, you want to get the type of fitness, and there's different types of fitness in terms of being able to play the style you want to play. You're right to say the distance covers have probably dropped down, but that makes perfect sense, those stats you gave me, in terms of the sprints, because of the way they set up. They sit deep now, they look to counter-attack, and they've got real verve, real pace when they do it. But that explosive nature is not something we saw under Mourinho. They were plodding along a lot, weren't they? At times, the centre-forward was being isolated so often, the midfield couldn't get in advanced areas of them. And that is maybe one of the reasons. But I think it just comes to a stage of the season now, as you quite rightly said, after a hectic Christmas period, that players do pick up injuries. It's just the way it is. And I think at times, when there is a lull, maybe if you go 10 days without a game, most coaches will do a little bit of a mini pre-season just to get some more energy into their legs, some more stamina for the remainder of the season. And unfortunately, it hasn't quite worked out for them.
Liverpool are up against Watford tonight. Watford, one of those teams that have had, by their standards, a brilliant season and coming off some good performances just recently. So it's the type of tricky game that you kind of would prefer different stages of the year. You want one of those teams who are reeling at the moment. Cardiff would have been the perfect game for Liverpool tonight.
Yeah, listen, a lot of Liverpool fans would like to pick and choose their games right now. But you're right, it'd be a tough challenge against Watford. Garcia has been so impressive. And it looks a natural fit. This is a coach who has had a bit of a nomadic existence, had so many jobs all over Europe. And obviously Watford hire and fire him so quickly, but they look like they're a good match. And he's done so impressive. Looked like they really could now challenge. And now that seventh position, especially with Wolves surprisingly losing to Huddersfield last night. But there's a physicality about Watford. They'll ask questions of Liverpool. They really will. And they'll have to stand up and be counted. But ultimately, if you're looking to win the title, you've got to be able to beat Watford. Simple as that.
Are they playing well enough at the moment? Because Andy Robertson was making the point that it was Bayern Munich and Manchester United who had thwarted their attacking prowess. Two pretty big clubs in world football, so that they shouldn't be panicked just yet. I can understand that he's like talking himself into it. And I can also understand that he's got a bit of a point.
Yeah, listen, there's so much been made about the front three maybe misfiring a little bit, bearing in mind the amount of goals they got last season. But the way they play has evolved. And they had to, because the opposition are not going to give you that space for Salah to run in behind. They're defending deep. So the problem Liverpool have maybe at this stage is they lack that creative player in midfield. They certainly lack a goal scorer in midfield. I think they got 6 goals from midfield from all their different options. That's not good enough. And it's in stark contrast if you think to City, the likes of De Bruyne. I know he's had injury problems, but Silva, the creativity they have, the goal threat that they have. But obviously Liverpool play a different way. They have to manage it. They have to get through it. And what they have got now is a defence that means they only need the one goal to win games. And that's what is so impressive. And that is the reason why they're so close to this elusive Premier League title.
Yeah, and do you just expect that the form City are in at the minute, that they roll over West Ham tonight?
I think the fact that it's the Etihad, I think West Ham will struggle. I really do. I think at times they lack a little bit of athleticism. I know they're slowly trying to change that with Declan Rice. some younger bodies in there, but I just think City will be too good for him.
All right, good stuff, Gary. Thanks a million.
Thanks, lads.
John Walters is going to be on update duty for us tonight from the Etihad from that game. So yeah, that's pretty interesting. Mm. Good timing because it's just in the papers today that it looks like he's going to be back before the end of the season.
Yeah, like interesting stuff in the papers as well today from Jurgen Klopp saying that this is the first chance for Liverpool to win the Premier League title, not the last chance. So it depends how you view that. Like the glass half full person would say, well, he's already starting to think about the possibility that they will not win the Premier League title. Well, but then that's the glass half empty person. The glass half full person would say to themselves, well, we've got tons of exciting years coming up.
Well, they do, right? If everybody calms down a little bit and it's like, he's not a manager who you automatically link with other jobs, right? The only other jobs in world football that you would automatically link him with in the past might have been somehow going to Bayern. I don't think that's going to happen. And the German job, why the hell would he take that? He doesn't need to. He can do that at any point in his life.
Yeah.
So he's found his perfect place. It's like if Spurs were just a little bit bigger and Pochettino was there now, he'd be there for life.
Let me ask you a question. How better do you think, on paper, how better do you think this Liverpool squad is to last year's squad? I would say they've made a slight improvement. Like Virgil van Dijk is obviously a hugely significant player. Yeah. But it is still...
At the start of the season and the end of the season?
Let's roll back to the midway point of last season.
Midway point.
Before they signed van Dijk.
Way better. They have a goalkeeper they trust. They have van Dijk.
Yeah, no, fair.
Now, the only thing is Salah's not at the World Footballer of the Year level that he was.
Well, Wijnaldum has become an absolutely top-class midfielder this season. Fabinho's been a very, very good addition, in my view.
Yeah, so they're way better than.
Yeah, and that kind of points to the fact why we need to kind of actually appreciate what an excellent season this has been for them. Because you look at where they were last year, what was it, fourth place?
27 points behind City.
25 points 25. Behind Manchester City. Previous year, fourth place, 17 points off Chelsea. The previous year to that, eighth, 21 points off top.
Big issues are the potential that Salah goes somewhere. But again, I suppose he could join Real Madrid. He could join Barcelona if Barcelona were to move on from Leo Messi, but that's not going to happen. So
Barcelona are going to move on from Luis Suarez at a certain point.
Yeah, maybe. Could he play with Messi? I mean, don't they like to take up similar-ish positions?
You throw enough quality at a team and it might make it better. Who knows? I don't think it makes sense personally. If you had a dream team in the world, you're not going to sign Salah for that position. But stranger things have definitely happened in terms of an attacking player that... I wouldn't say he's gettable or I wouldn't say he's available or anything like that, but you could do a lot worse than just firing him in there. I don't know, I think this Liverpool squad probably shares the mentality that a lot of us do, which is this has been a bloody good year for them, and as Jurgen Klopp says, this could be the start of something rather than the end of something, regardless of how the season finishes.
Yeah,
age profile is excellent as well.
Yeah, and then there are those times when Brendan Rodgers had the opportunity to win the league and it didn't happen. It never happened for him again.
Mm. Didn't come close again.
No. So let's assume Chelsea find a manager who is capable of putting together... Okay, so maybe Chelsea are probably not going to be that much of a force for the next couple of years if the transfer embargo happens. Although they do own 600 players who they can just take back from loan who might all turn out to be really good. So who knows? But let's assume they're not going to be there. Let's assume Spurs are going to be there because they're getting to their new stadium and they keep Pochettino because Man United keeps Solskjaer. And Solskjaer returns Manchester United to the level of competitiveness that they've had since he arrived, which is pretty damn good. City are obviously going to be there, thereabouts, every year. So maybe this is the one at-bat where most of your rivals, with the exception of Manchester City, are weakened. And so you need to take the opportunity.
Potentially, but unless...
Are Arsenal going to make a comeback? I don't know.
Not at that level. Not to a title-challenging level in the next 2 years. It's going to take a couple of years beyond that. But the danger is what you point out, is that if Barcelona just decide, yeah, I'm going to open the wallet, who do I want? And if Mo Salah is the unlucky contestant that they decide fits their game show, then it's going to be hard to keep him.
Or Real Madrid, because Andy West was on the football show last night talking about whether or not Gareth Bale is going to leave Real Madrid at the end of the season. Madrid and Barcelona are playing again tonight in the second leg of their Copa del Rey semi-final. The first leg was 1-1 at the Nou Camp, so here's Andy West's take on Bale.
And it was a very ugly gesture, and he didn't just shrug him off, he almost pushed him off. It was quite aggressive the way he did it. And the Spanish press has made a big deal out of this in the last couple of days. Not just that, there was a film captured him warming up on the sidelines with all the substitutes just before the first substitution was made. And when he saw that he wasn't the first player to come on, he immediately turned around, walked back to the bench and sat down. He voluntarily ended his warm-up. And then they captured him laughing sarcastically as the sub, it was Fede Vervelde, the young midfielder, was brought on and he was left sitting there. And it just didn't look good at all. He obviously is very unhappy not to be playing. And we know that he gets like this because he admitted very recently that at the end of last season he was very unhappy, and that when he came on in the Champions League final from the bench, he was still pretty angry. He admitted that himself.
Yeah.
Same situation now. So he's reacting in the same way. And it just doesn't help his image. He never has really made that much effort to engage with fans or the media. And when this kind of thing happens to him then, he's very vulnerable to being attacked, as he is at the moment. And it's going to be really interesting to see, firstly, if he plays tomorrow and on Saturday, and what kind of reception he gets from Real Madrid fans, because we all know Real Madrid fans don't mind whistling at their own players from time to time. So that's going to be interesting to see.
Yeah. Real Madrid fans and Kerry fans, the best fans in the world. I do wonder, is Gareth Bale any good anymore? I mean, he came off the bench in the Champions League final and was pretty damn good. Is he that good all the time? Or is he like too mercurial / injury prone at the moment to be consistent? So I guess if you were to go back to our conversation about Salah, if Real Madrid phone up and they say, okay, we'll give you 150 million for Mo Salah, do Liverpool go 150 million plus Gareth Bale and just stick Bale in their team and see what happens? Like, is that a possibility here?
150 million plus Gareth Bale.
Is Gareth Bale worth anything anymore? Like, how much has he worth?
I think he probably is. Like, you gotta remember that Champions League final that he won for Real Madrid was last year. We haven't even departed 12 months from that point.
Yeah, but he can't get in the team now. They're the ones depressing his value.
Like, I'm sure you saw the celebrations after Gareth Bale won.
Right.
He is a bit of an isolated figure, from what I can tell, at Real Madrid. Maybe the teammates don't like him that much. Maybe he doesn't like his teammates that much. He seems to be the...
Transfer market has his value at 80 million. So, yeah.
So you're basically offering 230 million for Mo Salah.
What's Mo Salah's buyout clause?
230 million isn't as ridiculous as I suspected it might have been, but I just can't see that happening. Maybe you'd get 100 million plus Gareth Bale, but even that, it's like very out of this world, and it would really mean that Real Madrid are pinning their hopes on Mo Salah for the next 5 years.
Ah, it doesn't. They doesn't. They can sell him on after a year if they don't like him. That's Real Madrid. It's like, this guy's good and famous. Let's get him on the team.
But the thing is,
for our Egyptian fans around the world.
Is he as famous? See, that's the thing. The fame part is so important.
Mo Salah is pretty goddamn famous.
Is he as famous as Neymar?
Not yet, but he would be after playing for...
And think of the soap opera that it would create when El Clasico happens next season with Neymar and the Real Madrid team.
You could play Neymar and Salah together.
So what, you go out... Like, you don't have two Gareth Bales to use as pawning chips, really.
The absence of a release clause in Salah's new contract is an added boon for Liverpool, so there is no release clause.
There isn't a release clause.
No.
Okay. Yeah, so that makes it more difficult.
Coutinho was 142 million.
Is that right?
Sterling?
When we talk about players that probably won't want to leave a ship that's sailing pretty smoothly, you look at Philippe Coutinho last year, and I'm sure he saw the potential in that Liverpool squad.
I'd say Coutinho's all right with how things worked out for him. I'd say it's grand. I'd say he's happy enough.
No, he is.
He's like...
He's certainly not disappointed.
Fat on his bed of money.
But does he get the real endorphin rush that being part of a stock that was rising from a low enough point?
Go out for a late night walk, you know? Breathe in.
Down
the
Rambla?
Breathe in. Well, more like he probably lives in the suburbs. Late night La Rambla is not very nice.
Well, you know, Philippe Coutinho might be into things that the rest of us aren't.
Before his lawyers, we're going to snip. Right, let's move on. We're talking rugby. As Ireland prepare for their penultimate Guinness Six Nations clash against France at the Aviva Stadium, their official partner, Dove Men Plus Care, is giving you the chance to be part of the captain's run. The winner will join the IRFU kitman, John Moran, as he prepares the dressing room for the Irish rugby team ahead of their final training session before the big game. And as if that isn't enough, the winner will also receive a pair of tickets to see Ireland against France at the Aviva the following day. This is a brilliant prize. It's a money can't buy prize. It's access to the Aviva Stadium for the captain's run, for the dressing room beforehand, chat with the kit man, get a bit of gossip for us, maybe do a bit of behind the scenes reporting. To be given the chance to win, just tell us what your favourite rugby jersey ever is. You can tweet us your comment when you're watching the show. Make sure you use the hashtag TeamCare and OTBAM so that we know you've answered. Here's a few of this morning's entries. The Babas, not just the look, but the team badge, spirit of both attacking and fair play. The team badge is cool. That's not my favourite Babas, the old Babas, the one that their amazing try that they scored against the All Blacks. So Ireland Rugby World Cup 2003 is next. I think this might be my vote, to be honest.
Oh, that's nice.
It is, isn't it?
Forgot about that one.
The two little lines, they're kind of simple. The World Cup jersey.
It doesn't feel very this century though, does it? It's almost as if like they forgot to update the jersey for the 2003 World Cup.
It's the last flabby one.
But it's just the simplistic design really that does it for me. It doesn't even look that flabby there. It probably makes it better. The more flabby, the worse, really.
The no design, the absence of design, really, apart from
that.
Which is also obviously a design. Harlequins 2018. Puke.
The result of a tie-dye t-shirt.
Come on, Brendan. He's been to Thailand and he's like, yeah, I was a hippie for a week. The old Harlequins jersey, like, you know, was okay, but I don't think it's going to win any competitions here. The Lions 2001.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm having that. NTL looks good as a sponsor as well.
Do you think so?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I'm absolutely having that. Like the
customer service left a little bit to be desired back in the day. Cable Link and NTL, Jesus fucking Christ. If you wanted to spend 25 hours on the phone to try and get your TV working. It wasn't even broadband, it was dial-up.
Yeah, I remember the dial-up sound vaguely.
Lions 2001, England 2008. I mean, stop nominating England jerseys. You're just not going to win. I'm telling you now, you're not going to win if you nominate an England jersey. And if you are going to nominate an England jersey, it has to be the 2003 World Cup one. That one just looks like there's been a spatter of blood on it. And anyway, screw you. We're not letting an England jersey win. That's not bad. The Italian 24 home jersey.
Why are you putting the flags on the sleeve like that? Like, what is with those three stripes with the Italian colours on it? Like, just leave it alone.
Unifying the various different parts of Italy.
Like, I know what it does, but you have to flag to do that. Just leave the sleeves alone.
No. It's the salad. That's what it is.
Is that where the Italian flag comes from?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I'm pretty sure it is.
It seems like a stereotypical sort of reason for it that you read on Wikipedia.
I mean, I should have just carried that one off and said, yeah, I can't believe you don't know this. You're too busy drinking in Budapest to find stuff out like this. Anyway, somebody can correct us on that. Hashtag OTBAM. Johnny Sexton popped into the studio yesterday afternoon for a good 20-minute chat. We're talking Joe Schmidt, the successor to his position, and why Irish rugby have stuttered their way through 2019 so far. Enjoy.
So Aer Lingus, the official airline of the Irish rugby team, is a smart choice for Irish rugby supporters this Six Nations Championship, as it helps bring home advantage wherever we play. And I'm delighted to say that Aer Lingus brand ambassador Johnny Sexton is with me in studio. Johnny, how are things?
Good, thanks.
So flew home from Italy yesterday morning. I dare say the previous 24 hours after the game, it was the main mood, frustration after what happened in Italy?
Yeah, frustration, you know, a better performance, relief that we got what we wanted to out of the fixture in terms of 5 points, but yeah, a lot of things that we had wanted to put out there didn't happen, and a lot of frustration really.
It must be a strange one, like getting a bonus point win away from home and having those feelings in the aftermath of the game.
Yeah, but that's the expectation now that we have on us, and I'm talking about expectation internally that we, you know, we expect to perform to close to our, you know, maximum every game, and when we don't, we're really disappointed. And over the last few weeks, we haven't managed to get to those highs just yet. And there's been reasons for that, but we just have to take it on the chin at the moment and just keep working hard and keep trying to fix some of the things. You know, if you saw us in training last week, you would have thought that we were going to go over and set the world alight in Italy, and things just didn't happen the way we had planned, but showed good resilience, I suppose, you know, coming out after half time and being a little bit better, you know, getting two tries to nothing conceded in the second half, and still wasn't brilliant, but it was good to come out of that with a win.
from a personal perspective, are you the type of person that after a game like that against Italy prefer to get straight back onto the training pitch immediately, or do you like to walk away a little while and actually analyse the tape a few days after perhaps?
Look, we know we're going to have to analyse it in camp together, you know, over the next few days when we're meeting up in Belfast, and we'll go through it together and we'll look for reasons as to why things just didn't happen as we would have wished. But yeah, we know I tend not to review too many things by myself. You know, I prefer to just do it with the coaches and with the squad and take those bits, because they're the learnings that you want to take from it. You know, I said earlier, one of my best attributes and my worst attribute is that I remember a lot of what goes on in the game. So, you know, it's what keeps me awake at night after every game, really, just thinking about things over and over. And it drives me crazy at times, but it probably helps me to get better and to improve. And, you know, it's, it can be frustrating when things aren't going as well as you would have liked, especially when you're doing everything right and you're training hard and you're preparing well, and just for whatever reason things just haven't clicked yet. But I'm confident that we can turn things around, and the good news is that we're still in with a shout of a championship with two games to go. And you know normally when there's a bit of doom and gloom, it's after three losses. We've lost one game, so we just have to take everything with a pinch of salt, and you know, realise that we're not performing as well as we can, but we will turn around at some stage.
When you say there's things that go through your head the night of a game and you're kind of playing the game over and over in your head, has there been a certain thing that's been in your head for the last three games? Is there a particular theme that you've been thinking about in the aftermath of a game?
No, they would have all been different. You know, that's the hard thing at the moment, is it seems to be different things each week that have, you know, against Italy it was just some basic errors. Against Scotland there was some sort of things in our shape that we weren't happy with, in terms of, you know, for example, just keeping our width in our attack, we just got narrow at times. And so there's just been little things in each game, and suddenly we fixed the one against after Scotland, but then we're making basic errors against Italy. So look, no one is frustrated as us as players and the coaches, and we want to set the world alight every time we go out and play, and it just hasn't happened so far. But like I said, I think it'll be a great thing for us coming into what's a huge, you know, next 10 months, really. It's going to be massive, and like, as much as we don't want to learn these lessons, it's good for us to learn them at this stage. You know, we thought we had a stage where we didn't need to learn lessons through adversity. We thought we could do it while winning, but sometimes you need a harsh sort of reality, and we're getting that at the moment.
Is it fair to say that that point where you thought you didn't have more to learn was immediately after the All Blacks win last year?
No, I suppose when we looked at that game after the All Blacks, as happy we were with some of our game, there was parts of it that we thought we could have definitely got better at, and we sort of targeted a few of those things, and we haven't sort of seen those things come to light yet, but we're working hard on them. And I think that we're that type of group. We're pretty driven, and after All Blacks we said we can definitely get better in these few areas, and we just haven't done it yet. We've shown it in training at times, and then for whatever reason we haven't quite put it out there on a Saturday. But like I said, not that it's better to happen now. You want to impress every time you play for Ireland and play for your country, but I'm sure we can turn things around for the last two games and then into a big summer.
I'm always interested in how a top level sports person can actually turn things around in the middle of a game. So say if you understand that something around you isn't going to plan, for example, which might have been happening in the Italy game or maybe even the first two games, do you have any triggers or anything like that to try and put what's happened out of your mind before that, to try and actually get yourself into a more positive mindset?
Yeah, it's something that is probably the hardest part about sport, isn't it? It's like, if you look at the Italy game, you know, if one guy makes one or two errors, and, you know, every guy makes one or two errors, suddenly you've racked up 30, you know, unforced errors, and, you know, things have gone terribly. So, you know, you can't put it down to one thing. It's just, everyone's just got to look after themselves, their own jobs, and trust that things will turn around. And like I said, we couldn't work any harder. We couldn't, you know, we care so much about doing well, and maybe we probably could have tried a little bit hard, you know, and rather than just concentrating on the basics, we maybe tried to force things a little and made these simple errors that we don't normally make. And like I said, no one's as frustrated as us.
Yeah, that's certainly been the theme over the last couple of days. Joe Schmidt saying that the trying a little bit too hard has certainly been a factor. And you said last week you were flying in training and all of that. Is one of the challenges now trying to channel that anger into correct places?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it's just trying to, you know, realize that we've lost one game in since Australia in the summer, and there's been a lot of changes. There's lots of reasons why we haven't clicked. But I'm not going to come out and explain them all, because they'll just look like excuses from us, and we need to be better. That's the bottom line. And but we do realise there's reasons behind not firing on all cylinders, and we will put it right, hopefully sooner rather than later.
Yeah, like at a time like this, there's so many different reasons thrown out as to why there might be a bit of an underperformance or why things aren't going fully Ireland's way at the moment. Is one of those reasons at all that Joe Schmidt is leaving at the end of the year?
No, I got asked that earlier. I don't think so. I think it was always going to be up in the air around November whether he was going to stay or go. I think some of the players had an inkling before the New Zealand game, for example, and we played pretty well that day. So change is going to happen in sport, and I think we're all professional enough that I don't know how that could affect us. That's not a problem. I suppose that's your guys' job, is to look into all these different conspiracy theories as to why things aren't clicking, and look into every avenue. And look, we've got some pretty simple solutions in camp. Unfortunately, we haven't quite fixed them on the day yet. But like I said, I think training-wise, things have been getting better, and we just need to put it out there next Sunday against France.
Yeah, because it seems to me that if the Joe Schmidt thing, if there's any truth in that, then there would be a complacency within the team. Whereas I think it's actually the other end of the spectrum, isn't it? That, as we've already mentioned, it's the kind of trying too hard a little bit or not actually focusing on the processes. It's the opposite end of complacency, really.
Yeah, you can never get complacent with the coaches that we have, because they always demand more. You know, even when we're winning, like I said, against New Zealand, that game, that first time we ever beat New Zealand at home, and we look at the review and they're demanding more from us, and they're picking holes in our performance, and that's what you want. And that's what's been like over the last 3 weeks, and we haven't been going so well. But we've got two wins away from home. You know, the hard one, of course, is losing at home to England. And you can look into all the conspiracy theories that you want, but we conceded some tries that day that we would never concede normally, and that just puts us in a position where, despite having played not as well as we would have liked, you know, we still were in a position to win the game with 20 minutes to go, and we conceded a try that we would never concede normally off first phase. And the margins are so small. You know, last year we won a Grand Slam, and we were talking about the margins being so small, and I think some of the media were going, yeah, whatever, you're just throwing out the regurgitated that we got told to say, but it wasn't. It was literally, like, you go back to that France last few minutes of the game, some of the decisions we made, like, you know, that crossfield kick, Keith takes it, you do a crossfield kick against England and there was no one there. You know, they're the margins that you live in. It's probably the same exact kick, probably, you know, executed just as well, but we're not on the same page at times, and that's the frustration from our point of view as well.
You mentioned the England game there, just a brief one on that. Is there still any remnants at all from that defeat because of, I guess, the manner in which it happened? Is there still a sort of psychological hit you've taken that we're still seeing the signs of?
No, I think, look, there's been a lot of changes personnel-wise since the England game. Certainly from England to Italy, there's been a huge amount of changes. Whether that's affected us, I don't know. But I think that, of course, there's a little bit of lingering there. It's going to hurt until the next time we play them, or at least the next time we play at home, which would be against France. And I haven't been in the dressing room much lower than that England game. So I'm sure it will, and maybe that Sunday against France will be the sort of bounce back that we're looking for, and take a big fixture like that to get us out of what's been a pretty frustrating place over the last few weeks.
For sure, it is a momentum shifter that kind of needs to happen at this point. And I guess when you look at the home venue now at this point, it's going to be a huge thing. Obviously, the Irish fans have travelled in numbers over the past couple of weeks as well. Like, how big a part can they play in terms of actually turning this thing around for the Ireland team?
Yeah, it's huge, isn't it? Like, I think the we were on the Aer Lingus flight going out on what it was a Friday, and the amount of people on it 2 days out before the game. Now, it helps that you're playing in Rome. It's a pretty cool city to visit, but you know, the Irish fans make such a difference everywhere we go. Like World Cups, doesn't matter where it is in the world, they're going to turn up and they're always going to be there, and it does make a huge difference to us. And we're conscious of that, and we're conscious that we want to put it right next Sunday for the people that come to support us that day.
Just a couple of things just to touch on before we wrap up. Joe Schmidt was in the newspapers this morning saying that you shifted three off the ball hits in Rome, and that was kind of the main reason for your frustration coming off the pitch. Is that the case, that once again we've had another week where perhaps the opposition has gone a little bit above the line?
But yeah, look, I was frustrated when I came off the pitch because things hadn't gone as well. We prepared really well, and it's pretty frustrating when you do all the right things and things just aren't happening on match day. And I was frustrated. Look, it's something that I try and be better at, is not showing my frustration at times. It's obviously still a work in progress, and look, guys care. You want to win, you want to play well, you want to do your best for Ireland, and when things don't go right, guys are unhappy, and I didn't show them the right way. But in terms of the off the ball stuff, that's not a plug. the hits away from the ball, like I don't know what to do anymore. Like, in terms of, sometimes I get straight back up, sometimes I try and stay down for a second so they might review it, or sometimes I retaliate, and nothing seems to work. So I just get on with it now. Like, it's not something that I overthink about. It can be frustrating when you want to stay in the game and, you know, get a second touch on the ball, and maybe that's why teams are doing it, because you can't play the wraparound plays, or you can't get a second touch or support on the inside. And yeah, look, it is what it is. It took three to get a penalty, and I suppose that was the frustration from that point of view. But not more I can do, really.
Is it gone up to a different level this year? Because it seems that we weren't talking about this at all last year, but that may also be the fact that we were kind of overreacting to the results and there was sort of no negatives to be spoken about whatsoever. Or do you really feel that 2019 has been a year where perhaps referees have let the opposition away with just a little bit more than they were in 2018?
I don't really want to speak about refs much in these type of forums. I don't think anything good can come of it. It'll look like maybe Sarah Graves if I say something bad, and I don't want to seem like I'm influencing refs, because I've been apparently criticised for that before. The refs will do their best, and I don't want to change how I play, or I just have to get on with it and just try my best. That's generally what we try and do, and sometimes it can come off and sometimes it doesn't, but just got to pick yourself up and go again.
So what you're saying is you don't have a red bat phone sitting there at home with a hotline to refs?
I definitely don't have a bat phone, no.
One last thing, I guess we may finish on like a more of a positive note, is kind of, I guess you look back to the last World Cup, 2015, a lack of depth was the thing we were talking about when it came to Ireland. And I think it's fair to say that regardless of what's actually happened so far in the Six Nations, we're in a stronger place when it comes to depth. There is a stronger squad there. 2015, of course, when it comes to depth, you were one of the examples that was used, that there wasn't a good enough backup at 10 when it came to that crucial Argentina game. How do you feel about that position at the moment? Of course, like Jack Carty made his debut at the weekend. Joey Carberry seems to be the backup at the moment, or first choice off the bench at the moment, with everybody fit. Are you looking around yourself at the moment in the squad and thinking we're much better set here if one of our big players goes down?
Yeah, well, I think that was one of the things from the Italian game. There's, like, if you look at our forward pack that played against New Zealand, for example, there's probably, I think, six changes there from that, and that's only three or four games ago. I think we've got some depth. I think that the quality of our performance probably didn't reflect that against Italy, but I think that over the last few years, through injuries or through, you look at the Six Nations last year when so our centres seem to be dropping one a game, and we seem to just be able to keep replacing them and not sort of drop off in standard. And I think the better that we are going into a World Cup, if we can have 38 guys, 30, 40 guys ready to go to a World Cup, and there's going to be 7 or 8 left at home that are ready, at that standard, well then that's exactly what you want. That's what New Zealand won the World Cup with, their, I think, 4th or 5th choice out half in the 2011. So, you need that depth, and I think we are in a better position across the board. You saw New Zealand when Murr wasn't around, that, Kieran Marmion came in and did really well, Luke McGrath coming off the bench as well. So there's good depth in every position, I think.
And is there a big focus on, say, the number one choice in each position to look after their understudy, to kind of teach them kind of thing, because there is a conflict between that school of thought and also the school of thought that you're a competitor and you need to be holding onto your jersey as much as you can.
Yeah, there's like, I don't think I ever, as a young lad coming through, I don't think I ever went up to a senior player and asked him for, you know, advice or could you sit down and teach me. So I think you'd learn from older guys by just being around them and looking at them in training, watching them and learning from them. And it's not up to me to, you know, I have too much respect for the guys, you know, they're competing for the jersey to go up and try and teach them things, because they're really good players in their own right. And if they want to learn or they want to ask advice from me, well, the best is just to watch us in training. And I think, you know, like I said, we're all competitors. We all want to, I want to stay in the number 10 jersey for as long as I can. And I know that, that Joey's doing well in Munster, Ross Byrne is playing well in Leinster when I'm not there, and Jack Carty's doing well in Connacht. And, you know, so there's great competition there, and that's the way you want it before World Cup, and it's the way it's always been. Like, I think I look back over the years, like Paddy Jackson at different stages when I was injured, and him coming in doing really well, Madigan coming in doing really well in that France game, for example, for Ireland. So there's always been competition there, and it's no different now, and there's some younger guys coming through, and it's my job to try and keep them at bay, and I just got to get my own levels of performance back to where I know I can get them, and I want to improve from last year, not just, you know, keep them at the same.
Yeah, and I guess when it comes to competition in your position, it probably helps that, you know, Joey's gone and he's starting games at 10 for Munster at this point. As we saw in Thomond Park around Christmas time, there's no lost love when you're wearing your provincial jerseys.
Yeah, look, a lot was made about that. A lot of nothing, really. Like, I spoke to Joey after the game and I couldn't believe the reaction. I had to do a press conference after. I couldn't believe the reaction of that. Like, there was a middle up beside the touchline, I pulled him out, and I didn't realise, he probably wasn't expecting it, but he went down much heavier than I had planned, and there was no words exchanged. I just said, get out of there, whatever. And I spoke to him after the game and said, look, I couldn't believe the reaction in the press conference. They were all trying to, you know, create a story about it. Just once, you know, there was nothing there. And he said, of course, like, there's no. So the amount of stuff that happened in that game, and it all came back to me, it was quite comical. But there's some good learnings in there for me in terms of how everything is going to be a little bit more in the spotlight sort of after last year. And I think it was a great sort of thing to happen to me, that game specifically. And I think the first few games of the Six Nations as well, like, in terms of sometimes when you play out half and you're in the spotlight and things aren't quite clicking, you know, you can make some mistakes. Some of my own, of course, like a kick, a restart against Italy in the full, and things like that. That you're totally your own. But sometimes you can pass the ball out in front of someone and we don't run onto it, or you can, you know, think someone's in a different position. So when things aren't quite clicking, it can sometimes make things seem worse than they are. But you've got to take the experience, I suppose, teaches you to keep doing the things you have, and things will come right eventually.
Yeah, just a reminder, Aer Lingus, the official airline of the Irish rugby team, is a smart choice for Irish rugby supporters in the Six Nations Championship, as it helps bring home advantage wherever we play. Aer Lingus ambassador Johnny Sexton, thanks a million.
Thank you.
Yeah, he made some coffee, checked out his new desk.
Did he? I missed that. I was obviously here preparing, but obviously the main thing he was here for was to check out his new digs.
Yeah.
And by all accounts, he's loving settling in.
Yeah, just can't work the photocopier yet. It's tricky. It's fair enough. There has to be cutthroat competition between professionals when you're trying to take each other's jobs, right?
Well, yeah.
Or are you supposed to actually go, yeah, when I'm running the game, I always find that I do this, this, and this. Like, how much mentoring do we legitimately expect people to do to the person who's trying to take their job?
That's an excellent question, and I think it kind of depends on the individual themselves. First of all, how good an educator are they? You could be brilliant at being an out-half and be terrible at teaching somebody to be an out-half. That's like an occupational hazard of that particular setup. So I don't think that's encouraged, but if it happens and you kind of have the belief in yourself that you can impart knowledge fairly well, then you're going to go ahead and do it if you feel very comfortable in your own skin. And didn't Brian O'Driscoll say that he used to bring Robbie Henshaw on as far as he possibly could in terms of tutoring him, yeah, just because it'd bring himself on further again?
It was also clear that Henshaw was going to be better 12 than 13, so that was grand.
That helps, yeah. That helps. So when it's only one person at 10, it makes things a little more tricky.
Mm. Yeah. It would be interesting to see what everybody would do now. If you're like somebody who's just like 3 or 4 years younger than you, they're there to slit your throat. It's going to improve each other in competition. That's how it works, right?
It's going to improve the national team, and it's going to improve whatever setup you're in at the moment. But really, there has to be a level of selfishness attached to it all. Like, you have to be thinking about your own back. You have to be thinking about your own jersey. It would be unhuman to think any other way. Of course, a team is important, but the reason why you want the team to succeed is because you're going to derive some happiness from it. So it is like a selfish endeavour in the first place, is it not?
Yeah, generally. Seamus Bannon has been on the early morning Kool-Aid. Alexis Sanchez and Gareth Bale in a swap deal. Great for all involved, says Seamus. I mean, great for all involved if you're Manchester United. Not great if you're Real Madrid, who gets stuck with Alexis Sanchez's crappy contract and his shot legs. There's a possibility Gareth Bale shot as well. You know, he's been at it since very young. He's hit very high heights.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they were unsustainable.
Maybe they were unsustainable. And maybe Alexis Sanchez can reach some heights again under a new setup. Or maybe Alexis Sanchez needs a break for a while, although it seems he's had that by not playing very many minutes.
Jimmy McCullough was in touch about the jerseys. The 2013 Scotland away jersey he has on Twitter using the hashtag TeamCare and the hashtag OTBAM. It's part of our competition this morning to give you the opportunity to be part of the captain's run. You'll get to shadow the kitman ahead of the captain's run for Ireland's last home Six Nations game against France, courtesy of Dove Men Plus Care. And that jersey, if you don't remember it, is white at the top and then it has like a Scottish flag underneath it. And I don't know, I'm not convinced, Jimmy. He says it's a classic. Classic is like plain white, plain navy, plain green, plain classic.
Yeah, plain all the way. There is there any current jersey, I wonder, that can go down as a classic? The Welsh jersey, maybe, at the moment. It's quite nice. I can't really think beyond that. Like, it's... I know you said a while ago that we're not going to accept any English jerseys winners.
Go on.
But...
what do you want?
There is something about the white jersey. As a Kildare man, you can appreciate that.
I mean, I always kind of wanted us to change our colour. It's like... white is grand, but here's one apparently, says Tommy. Oh yeah.
Oh my god.
So this is Stade, right?
They do this a lot, don't they?
I wonder what year this is from. Stade at least have, like, you know, they change things around. They do stuff. They're inventive. Doesn't always work. Are these like, there's
do they link up with The Sims or something?
I don't know what the background to this one in particular is. Is this how recent is it, I wonder? The current Wales one is pretty good. It's actually great. There's nothing on it apart from logo, the leak, and the Under Armour.
I'm a very plain man.
Sponsor.
Anything that's plain is fine. I don't like, even if you're like giving me a 99 and you're going at it with the sauce, like, stop with the sauce. Just plain is better in every walk of life, and especially when it comes to food and clothes.
Not food. Otherwise, yeah. Alright, so Tommy Walsh was talking with Joe last night on Off the Ball yesterday evening, looking back at the weekend's hurling. He also shared his memories of going to matches as a kid.
It's amazing, Joe, like that. Them young lads, I'd love to take a photo of them young lads and see, will any of them play for Limerick in, say, 20 years' time? Yeah. They probably will. There'll probably be one or two of them.
Yeah, you'll probably see the photo in the paper, yeah. Sorry, go on, you remember what? Yeah.
Like, I remember that when we were going to matches, one of the great thing about going to a match was getting the hurling ball. Say, you know, don't want to say robbing the hurling ball, but sure, I suppose that's what we were doing. So you'd be there waiting behind, maybe your father would be playing the match, and you're going and you have no hurling ball. You could come back with 5 or 6 hurling balls because, and it all depends on the strength of the umpire then as well, because you have to judge the umpires, Joe, because some of them, they'd be from hurling backgrounds and they let you off. And you go off and you get a hurling ball, you'd pretend, what you used to do is you'd pretend that you couldn't find it, but you'd kind of stamp it into the ground, and then when the umpire wouldn't be looking, you'd pick it up and off you go and you'd show all your friends. But then the umpires would get cuter and they'd come looking for the hurling ball. So what we used to do then is one of the lads in the class came up with a great idea. You'd have an old hurling ball. So you'd bring an old hurling ball that wasn't any good anymore. It was bet probably 100 times or 1,000 times off the wall. And when the umpire come looking for the ball, you'd give him the old hurling ball and you'd go off to span new one. A Cork All-Star or a Newry ball.
Dear. Suddenly I feel like I know you a whole lot better.
Class. Darren, how are you?
Good morning, Ger.
You've got a favourite rugby jersey for us?
Yeah, it's... I don't have a picture here in front of me. I have a picture in front of me which is no use. It's from 2015. And it was an Irish rugby jersey. Owen can see it, which is probably no use to anyone else. But I sold it for a vast sum of money to the World Rugby Museum in Twickenham. Because it was Jamie Heaslip's jersey.
But it's actually Jamie Heaslip's one.
Yeah.
And how much did he sell it for?
I don't want to say on the radio in case Jamie Heaslip is listening.
All right. Wow.
Of course.
Wow. So how did you get it?
Again, I don't want to say that on air in case.
Did you? Are you like the New York, the New England Patriots guy?
No, not that bad. No, I've collected jerseys for years, match worn jerseys.
All right.
Give us a hint on figure, like how many Freddo bars could you buy with this?
Tommy says don't push him on it because for fear that the cops will swoop.
No. It was legitimately got.
So he handed it to you?
No, he didn't hand it to me.
Right.
But I don't.
You gave permission to the person who handed it to you to hand it to you.
Well, I'm not sure if it got that deep, but it passed the chain of possession was well explained.
And so the 2015 World Cup from a specific game or
no? It's from the Six Nations that year.
Okay, the Six Nations that year.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's from the Wales game.
And who buys them?
Collectors. I sold mine to the World Rugby Museum in Twickenham.
Why do they want it?
They wanted a Heaslip jersey.
Was there any Heaslip jersey from any time in his career? And
well, there's Six Nations games, obviously.
And you're keeping an eye out there. It's like, oh, I can fill that one. I mean,
most of the collectors would stay in touch. And
all right,
I was
a little
looking to move it. And I knew a guy who knew a guy at the World Rugby Museum who was interested in it. So that's how we made it happen.
And are you a collector in general? Do you have a lot of very expensive memorabilia?
You had that 28 Dublin jersey.
That was me.
There is no number 28, but you had it.
No, but I had it. But it would have been an extra spare where everyone on the panel would, beyond the 26, everyone on the panel would get a shirt.
And
high up into the mid 30s, I'd say.
And so, but what was noticeable this year was that everybody got number 27 in
Limerick.
It was at Limerick, and somebody said, "Oh, this is that always happens." And I was like, "But hang on, there's a number 28 here, so it doesn't always happen."
No, well, I it may be different in other counties, but Dublin gave numbers up to. I think I've seen Dublin jerseys number up to 30, 32.
Oh, they're turning on the lights. Maybe we're going to get a view. Is that what's happening? Is there going to be a camera that swivels on its head? Look at this. You're going to see that our stadium is absolutely massive. Hey,
there you go.
Genius.
I've got a lot of Irish soccer jerseys. There you go.
Any of them actually worn or owned previously by professional Irish soccer players?
Yeah, all of them. The whole point of match-worn jerseys is they're worn by people who played in matches.
Whose jerseys?
Got a Robbie Brady, a Jeff Hendrick, had a Wes Hoolan that I moved on. Tried to get Robbie Keane for a few years, but I haven't managed it yet.
I love the way you like refer to it like a Monet, a Wes Hoolan.
A Wes Hoolan, yeah.
That's incredible. And like, how do you get your hands on all these things?
I don't know. I just started years ago. I did my work experience at the time with the kit man from Shells, and at the end of it, he gave me a Shells jersey. I'm like, oh, this is kind of cool to have a jersey that the players wore. And then it just became like an odd hobby that I've continued into adulthood.
And do you get them framed or do you just...
No, I think framing can damage them sometimes. So I prefer to just keep them. They're actually in a closet, which isn't the best place for them, but they're well preserved and well looked after.
How big is your collection?
I probably have maybe 25 match-worn Irish shirts.
Rugby and football?
Soccer, just soccer.
Right.
Yeah, I had one rugby jersey and it was Heaslip and I moved it on.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
So you would recommend trying to win this competition and shadowing the kitman for a day? It could be the start of a lifelong thing.
Expensive, really expensive hobby. I think if Tommy goes through his WhatsApps, I send him a WhatsApp picture of some of the soccer jerseys I have a couple of months ago when he was looking for jerseys for his wall.
Go through your WhatsApps there.
You'll find it, Tommy. But yeah, no, I have a good few. I've never actually got one from anyone who works here.
All right, I'm sure... Killer, I mean, we have the killer one from the first leg of the France. We didn't get the Paris game. We got the Dublin game, didn't we?
You might swap me. I've got some things you might want.
Oh yeah?
You might be interested.
Like what?
Well, I've nothing belonged to him, but I don't know, maybe he's got something I want.
I'll give you back your jersey.
Villa jersey. I've a Kieran Clark Aston Villa jersey from the UEFA Cup years ago. You might want that.
All right. From like that's a long 5-6 years ago?
Maybe more. It's been longer since they've
been. He must have been a kid.
He must have been a kid.
Kieran Clark?
Yeah, they spelled his name wrong.
Alright, okay.
So it's rare.
Somebody else?
No, it's Kieran Clark.
Right.
Yeah. He was so young they put an extra E on his name.
And so what's your most valuable one?
I don't know, because the value changes. Like if a player retires and had a pretty decent career, it depends on the I suppose, the match. I had a Joey O'Brien jersey from the, was it the 1-1 draw in Germany?
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, so that would be pretty valuable. But it, again, depends on the significance of the match. Ones from major tournaments are very, very worthy of commanding a big price. Although if it's a major tournament like Euro 2012 or we're terrible, they would be less valuable.
I'd like the Keith Andrews shirt from the game he got sent off and he kicks the Italian up the hole. Like, yeah, good man.
Yeah, because mainly he was the only player that came out of Euro 2012 with a reputation enhanced.
Yeah, exactly.
Everyone else was terrible.
What have you got for us, Tommy? Hold on, he says. Hold on.
He's got it.
Oh, he's got something. The suspense is killing us here. Holy shit! That's Darren's collection. Wow!
So Holland was Graeme Kavanagh. There's number six. I saw that a while ago. Above that, Slovakia, John O'Shea.
So slow down. The Ireland-Holland game with...
That was a friendly in Lansdowne Road. I think we were beaten in it. That was Graeme Kavanagh's. I sold it. To the right is Robbie Keane from a friendly against England in Wembley.
Oh yeah, the Shane Long goal.
Yeah, yeah. Above that, I think is Germany Joey O'Brien.
Do you do have a Robbie Keane one? It's not match worn.
It's not match worn. It's issue.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm trying to get a match worn one. Russia number 15. That's Mark Kinsella. I think that's the European qualifier. That one is not issue or worn. The one that Tommy is sending on set at the moment.
Yeah.
And because obviously he never played in the World Cup, so.
So what is this? This is the pre-World Cup.
I think it was made up for sponsors, for corporate people.
Pre-World Cup, 2002.
Pre-World Cup, yeah. So it's a pretty old shirt.
It's a nice jersey.
Yeah?
It's a very nice jersey.
Oh, that's so disappointing. It's so disappointing.
I'd love to get Keane to sign it. I wonder would he be amenable.
Didn't you already ask him?
No, I was going to, but I thought he was coming in here.
So you could move it on.
It would be much more valuable. A Roy Keane signed World Cup shirt.
Yeah, get him to sign the World Cup ball. That was the other thing that we were going to do.
Yeah, I'm not so sure he'd respond well to that. So if anyone is watching and collects jerseys and wants to
you could just
do
give
a swap
it to
shop,
him
let me know.
What was this? It's
put a bit of tracing paper on it. Ask for his autograph on the paper. Oh, look, it's appeared on the cloth.
There was the great story of Keane where someone asked him for a picture a while ago and he said, why? Also, people will know I met you. So just tell them you met me.
And can you not like Google Roy Keane's autograph and just replicate it on that and then sell it for however many thousands of euros you got?
No, you see, like your reputation is everything in any kind of hobby involving collecting. So if you stay above board, you're fine. If you have a good reputation and if people know you to act honestly with what you say, provenance is sometimes hard to prove. So a lot of the jerseys, people wouldn't bother faking them. People wouldn't go to the effort and it'd be a bit difficult because you would need an awful lot of elements to go right. Even like the font of the writing of the match detail is the one that generally is you're able to tell provenance from. But for the most part, no one would fake it if they wanted to actually stay in the business of collecting shirts.
The collections game.
Denny Ryan
collections
says,
game.
I know a lad got his hands on the jersey that Ronnie Whelan wore when scoring that goal versus Russia in Euro 88. A few years later, his wife did a spring clean and sent it to a charity shop.
Oh.
I wonder where it is now.
No.
So somebody just bought it from a charity shop and maybe doesn't know that it's
abroad.
The rugby lads are very good for doing like gear dumps to charity shops where they'll put all their stuff in bags. Now, I'm not sure if jerseys would generally be what they put in, but I've heard one or two stories of Irish rugby match-worn jerseys ending up in charity shops by players who just, you know what, I'll give this to a charity shop, they make a few bob. And they don't tend to get any kind of credit for it, even though it's a really admirable thing, because then collectors rush out to the charity shop and steal good money. Yeah.
I was asked during the England game, what happens to the jerseys? Do they just get washed? And I was like, no, they don't get washed. They just get new ones for the next game. But what does happen to them?
Two or three jerseys, I think, per game is what players get.
And they get to keep they just take them home.
Yeah, they keep them. Sometimes they will give them to the kit man or not be bothered keeping them, or they'll swap them. They tend to swap one and keep one, and I'm not sure what happens to the third one. A lot of the times, player sponsors at clubs anyway would get third jersey.
Yeah, fair enough.
But yeah, for the most part, I'm not like, I always find it weird when players talk about their memorabilia. Most of them don't seem too arsed.
No. Like it's not really a thing in this part of the world.
No, it's not at all.
It never became something like in America where like stuff changes hands for millions of dollars. And because Japan got interested in baseball, Japanese collectors inflated the market for that stuff. But like you still have these superstars of the game showing up to signing events where they'll get $5,000 and the queue will be 4 hours long and they will literally sign and sign and sign. Everybody's paid 50 quid to get in. So everybody makes money. The people getting the stuff signed, stick it on eBay, the former great player who's reduced to, you know...
It's really important, though, particularly because there's no formal way for the FAI or soccer bodies in this country to preserve that stuff and keep it. Private collectors are so important because they hold a pretty valuable piece of history. It mightn't seem like it at the time, the games mightn't seem so relevant, but at the same time it's really important to preserve this stuff and have it for future generations, to have some kind of mark of where we were 10, 15, 20 years ago.
If Gilesy had a collection of memorabilia, it would be amazing.
Like, that stuff should be in a museum.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just sports history, it's a lot of it is pop culture history.
At Dove Mencare, at Off the Ball, classic South African jersey from 1995. It is a classic.
That's a lovely shirt. Really nice.
Yeah, it looks like it's like accidental that it's going to be used in a game, you know?
It's impractical.
It is a bit impractical.
Which actually adds to the charm.
Yeah. But it is class. All right, what do you got for us this morning?
Yeah, I'll get out of the jersey wormhole. It's been an eventful few hours at Celtic. At 6:45 on Tuesday, Brendan Rodgers departed the club to take charge of Leicester. Then at 7:05, they had his replacement. Neil Lennon has returned to paradise. Former Irish international Damien Duff will serve as coach for the new manager. Rodgers, meanwhile, watched from the stands as Leicester beat Brighton 2-1 in the Premier League last night. We will hear from him in a moment, but first, here's Neil Lennon.
There's a wide range of emotions. First one's obviously pride. The privilege of doing this job again, and obviously a huge amount of gratitude for, you know, the club taking a leap of faith in me once more. So difficult circumstances, obviously there's a chasm to fill with Brendan leaving.
I was certainly in no hurry to leave Celtic. Celtic is a club that's a huge club, you know, worldwide renowned club, and loved working with the players there. We were on a journey of great success over these last 3 years, probably achieved and taken the club maybe at Celtic as far as I could at this moment.
Now, Gylfi Sigurdsson relieved the pressure on Marco Silva with a goal in each half in Everton's 3-0 win at Cardiff. Steve Mounier scored a dramatic injury time winner to end Huddersfield's 3-month winless run. They beat Wolves 1-0 while Fabian Schär's excellent strike and Sean Longstaff's first Premier League goal helped Newcastle beat Burnley 2-0. Rafa Benitez's side are now 7 points clear of the relegation zone. Mauricio Pochettino believes Tottenham's mental frailty may be holding them back from mounting a serious Premier League title challenge. Spurs failed to close ground on Man City and Liverpool, losing 2-1 to Burnley at Turf Moor last weekend. Pochettino's side take on Chelsea at Stamford Bridge later, but the manager insisted it could take him upwards of a decade to undo the club's problems and turn them into a title-winning side.
We need to try in different ways that we try it in Burnley. I think what disappoints the most and frustrates the most is that it was so easy for Burnley to beat us, and that is more painful when we knew that it's going to be a game, a difficult game, and I think I not only I told you, I told everyone that I was worried to translate the player, that it's going to be a game that you need to match the aggressivity and the way that they fight, and we didn't match them in this aspect, and that is why we lose the game, and that is very painful.
Now, Southampton's Republic of Ireland international striker Michael Obafemi has been ruled out for the rest of the season with a recurrence of a hamstring injury after 2 months missing with a hamstring problem. Obafemi came on as a half-time sub. With the Saints trailing Arsenal 2-0 at the Emirates last weekend, his appearance was short-lived. He quickly pulled up with a similar problem. Now, the Saints manager, Raf Hasenhüttl, believes the issues are being caused by the player's posture. He says, "It's very disappointing that he is again injured. It is a problem he knows with his body because of his body shape, and the posture is a very stiff one. We must change the treatment for the future because in this situation we see it doesn't work what we try to do with him."
Digger was in touch saying that it must be a serious tendons off the pubic bone type hamstring injury, but it doesn't sound like that. That's not what they've said, that this isn't, that it's a chronic situation, but that it isn't, it hasn't re-ripped, right?
No, the suggestion seems to be that
this is rest.
The fear is that it's going to be a recurrence over and over again, so they'll get him match fit and then he's very likely to do this again. So they want to make sure that they pretty much look at the way he's running, look at the way he's training, and they seem to do it a different way.
They seem to be shutting him down preventatively as opposed to it being in response to what's just happened, right?
Yeah, I think when they say season ending, I don't think it's a particular serious injury. I think the problem is the fact that it's the same injury in such quick succession to it happening a couple of weeks ago. So he did wait a long time to get back from it, and I think the suggestion is it's preventative and trying to safeguard his future and make sure that hamstring injuries are not going to be something that will plague him going on for the next few years.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of injuries, Joey Carby could miss the rest of the Six Nations. There are fears that the Munster out-half's hamstring injury is worse than initially feared. Carby suffered the setback last Thursday in training in Maynooth and is now a doubt for Munster's Champions Cup quarter-final against Edinburgh next month. Jack McGrath could join Jordy Murphy in leaving Leinster to join Ulster. Reports suggest talks are at an advanced stage. McGrath and the IRFU have apparently grown frustrated with the lack of starting opportunities at Leinster. McGrath has been battling with Keane Healy for a starting spot this season, more often than not losing that battle. While Shane Lowry says he is surprised by criticism of Rory McIlroy's decision to miss this year's Irish Open, the former world number one will skip the tournament at Lahinch to instead focus his preparations on the Open Championship. The 29-year-old is already competing in the Scottish Open a week prior to the Open, and Lowry said he completely understood McIlroy's choice to miss the Irish Open. He's quoted RTE as saying, "Every Irish player involved in golf in Ireland that actually knows something about golf wouldn't have a bad word to say about him. The Open Championship is the biggest tournament he'll play, being in Portrush, and he feels he needs to prepare for that." Now, Paul McGinley was on Off the Ball last night, and he answered a similar question.
It's not about owing it to anybody, owing it to me. To me, it's not about that, you know. I mean, I kind of like the bloody-mindedness about it, to be quite honest. I think you need to have that about you to be a top player in the game. And I think it's lacked a little bit sometimes in the last few years. We haven't seen him being absolutely headstrong. So I don't have a problem with that. But I do have a problem when I think that, you know, if you look at the Scottish Open golf course, it's not a really, really pure links golf course in the same essence that Lahinch is. And if you really want to prepare, personally, I don't think you need to play the week before in order to go and play well. I think you could easily have a quiet weekend. But look, it's all a matter of opinion. I think Lahinch is a really good setup. I've been working with the RNA to get some kind of ideas on fairway widths and green speeds and runoff areas and try to make Lahinch as much aligned. The terrain is not too dissimilar if you think about it. And I'm trying to get it as much aligned so that the guys come here as really good prep for the Open Championship. And I think it's going to be great prep. And you could really argue very strongly that it's going to be better prep than playing a golf course that's not really very similar to how Portrush is going to play. But look, that's only a matter of opinion, Joe.
Sure.
And, you know, as I say, the proof will be in the pudding. But in some way, I kind of admire the bloody-mindedness about him. And I think that's something that can be construed in the wrong way. But to be the top at anything you do in your life, you've got to really have the courage of your convictions. And if that's what he has, that's what he has. And unfortunately, we lose out as Irish people. But he's certainly not moving, turning his back on the Irish Open from everything that he said. And we'll look forward to having him again.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's my lot. Keep up to date with all the latest sports news and views on offtheball.com.
You want to talk briefly about Romelu Lukaku?
Romelu Lukaku, writing about him in the Irish Daily Mail this morning. Michael Clegg with an inside piece here, why Lukaku needs to lose some muscle. So this is with regards to, not totally linked to the Solskjaer story that he's kind of taking a bit of blame for injuries, but it's not too dissimilar either, that Michael Clegg, he's a former Manchester United player and ex-Sunderland strength coach, says that Romelu Lukaku doesn't need to stop going to the gym, but could perhaps go to the gym in a different manner. So he needs to... He clearly does a lot of...
Waits for dates.
Yeah. What does that mean?
Waits for dates.
Well, I've never heard that phrase before. Well, believe it or not, I'm not a gym bunny and I'm not completely accustomed to the slogan.
People who do waits for dates.
Okay.
As opposed to for physical...
Prowess.
Gym. Yeah.
Well, Romelu Lukaku.
Vanity.
Romelu Lukaku is doing a lot of weights for dates, if I can use that phrase.
And, it doesn't look like he's doing a lot of weights there. It kind of looks like he's been, you know, sitting on the couch having the crack.
That's not the physique of a man sitting on the couch chair, in fairness.
There's not a lot of definition.
What couches do you sit on?
Yeah. He looks exactly like me.
Like when Homer looks in the mirror and he sees a reflection that is not his reflection at all.
So basically, the three of us really know what I'm talking about here. So Lukaku does a lot of hypertrophy work, which is 8 to 12 repetitions on your squats to bench press. I know the feeling. It can cause the sarcoplasm in a muscle to increase. Again, it's such a familiar idea. That's not just the muscle itself, but the area around it. It's what bodybuilders like me do to look bigger, but it's not always functional. If you reduce those exercises to 3 to 5 repetitions and still do it with a heavy load, it won't give you that same size increase, but the muscle itself will stay really strong. So basically, Lukaku can still train in the gym, but you want to minimise the size of his muscle system. You get him doing aerobic conditioning on a watt bike or rowing and swimming. You don't want size, you want speed, a fast contraction of the muscle. So you can stay strong, but slim down a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
So to paraphrase, his ectoplasm is giving him a heavy load.
Oh yes, exactly. That's it. You know, it's a familiar feeling. Always hits me on a Wednesday morning.
All right, the Gaelic Football Show is back today at 12:30 with John Fogarty joining Shane Stapleton, Owen and Tommy in studio. Off the Ball returns to the radio tonight for 7 o'clock Wednesday Night Rugby, and Johnny Walters, who's at Manchester City against West Ham for us. We're back tomorrow morning at OTBAM live from 7:45 a.m. with Kieran Donnelly, Shot Clock, and the Leinster head coach Leo Cullen in an exclusive interview. We're going to leave you with this. You can check out the full interview over on our YouTube channel. It's world champion Kelly Harrington on the show last night speaking about her hunger to get back in the ring.
It was, yeah. There's no point denying it. Like when you're getting ready for a national elite final, you expect to be fighting a national person, like an Irish person. You're always geared up for it because there's always a real challenge. Like you have to win it, you know. Like you have to win it.
Yeah.
But it's different this time. I didn't have that, like, I have to win this, you know, like, not that I was going in thinking, like, oh, I don't have to win it either, you know, but that little bit of an extra push wasn't there for me, you know, but I was just delighted to get the fight either way, you know. Yeah. I definitely, like, if I hadn't got the fight on Saturday, I would have been very, very disappointed, like, this week I'd be snapping, basically, because that's where everyone wants to be is in the finals of the elites. But as well as that, for my own preparation going forward, to get rid of the rust as well, I wanted to be back in there in an environment where there's people sitting around the ring and judging, and like the atmosphere and the nerves and all. I wanted to feel that again, so when I'm going into my next competition, it's not just happening and I'm feeling it there. I'm like, oh, this is overwhelming. So do you know what I mean? It's all a part of the process.
So if you like this, you'll probably also like OTBAM, Ireland's only sports breakfast show. Subscribe to the OTBAM podcast stream or catch the show live on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook or offtheball.com every morning from 7:45 a.m.